Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Toni Rielli, and I am the Coastal Program Coordinator for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. As part of my position with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, I manage a diverse network of environmental advocates, local elected officials, academics, business owners, and entrepreneurs from Maryland to Louisiana. What you see on your screen is a slide for this group I manage called the Florida Climate Alliance. And the Florida Climate Alliance is dedicated to fostering state leadership for mitigating and adapting to the challenge of global warming. And our alliance promotes protection of Florida's uniquely valuable resources, increasing awareness of the threats and opportunities posed by global warming and encouraging solutions at every level of government, local, state, and federal. The Florida Climate Alliance is part of a much larger group called the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, which consists of other Southeast Coastal organizations working towards climate solutions from Louisiana to Maryland. If you are already a member of the Florida Climate Alliance, I especially welcome you today. And for those who are not and are interested, the link there is at the bottom. And the host organization for the Florida Climate Alliance is the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And today we're going to be talking about Florida's renewable energy future. And we have two co-hosts today, George Kavros and Susan Glickman. George is an energy law attorney in private practice in Fort Lauderdale who works with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy as a clean energy policy consultant. He has testified and provided written comment to the Governor's Climate Action Team, the Department of Environmental Protection, the Florida PSC, and the Florida Energy Commission on issues ranging from energy efficiency implementation to cap-and-trade policy design. Susan Glickman has been involved in issue advocacy and political campaigns since 1984, working both at the federal level and in her home state of Florida. The current focus of Susan's work is with climate and energy issues in the state. Susan is a consultant to the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and CERES. Most recently, Susan served as the U.S. Southern Region Director for the Climate Group, an international non-governmental organization working to accelerate a low-carbon economy. So I'd like to thank George and Susan for taking time today to lead us through this presentation. And at this time, if you'd like to take over, George.
Great. Thanks, Toni.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And thanks for joining us today, folks. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy was heavily involved in the 15-month Renewable Portfolio Standard rulemaking workshops at the Public Service Commission in 2007 and 2008. And, you know, we'll talk about the PSC rule when we later on in the presentation when we talk about the bills that are in play this session. SACER, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, has advocated for meaningful renewable energy policy, not only for the environmental benefits, but for the economic and ratepayer protection benefits as well. You know, Florida's at a crossroads right now. We're approaching 12% unemployment. Some of our traditional economic sectors, such as real estate development and tourism, have declined due to global economic crises outside of our control, and it's a time where legislative leaders are being called upon to create jobs, but yet be sensitive to not adding additional burdens on struggling Floridians, and the pursuit of a state clean energy policy really provides a unique opportunity for this year's Florida legislature to create another state economic engine that will draw private investment to the state, create new jobs, and also assist Florida utility customers. Next slide, Toni. And Southern Alliance for Clean Energy estimates that a target of 20% renewable energy by 2020 would create over 50,000 jobs in Florida. That's based on job studies by Navigate Consulting and the University of Florida. And conventional sources of energy really just can't match these types of numbers. You know, biomass is obviously a big driver of jobs. It's the largest renewable resource right now in Florida. And biomass generally can be broken down into several categories. It can be agricultural waste. It can be electricity created through the combustion of energy crops. Municipal solid waste is a source of biomass, as is methane from landfill operations. And right now, about 520 megawatts of municipal solid waste actually sort of lead the biomass category in Florida for generating electricity. We get about 190 megawatts from agricultural waste and about 55 megawatts from landfill methane operations. Just by the way, 1 megawatt can power about 600 homes. We have about 7% of the nation's biomass resources. Florida is sometimes called the Saudi Arabia of biomass because of our year-round growing season and vast expanses of land. And we actually have the largest biomass electricity plant in the nation just south of Lake Okeechobee. It's owned by Florida Crystals, and it converts sugarcane waste to electricity, and it's about 140 megawatts. Solar is also a resource that we are not short of in Florida. Our solar resource is only second to the U.S. Southwest, but we've had really very little solar before last year in Florida. We will have an extra 110 megawatts of solar by the end of this year, and that's due to a special provision in a 2008 energy bill that provided full cost recovery for the state's largest utilities up to 110 megawatts to build demonstration solar projects, and FPNL had taken advantage of that 110-megawatt allotment and is building the Martin County plant that has already completed a plant in DeSoto and is building one on the Space Coast. But still, solar energy comprises much less than 1% of the energy mix in Florida. Next slide, please. So what are green jobs or clean energy jobs? Well, a lot of them, almost 75%, are manufacturing and construction jobs, and those are exactly the skills of many in the construction trade who are now unemployed in Florida. Those folks are really poised to hit the ground running in the new clean energy economy. Next slide, please. And I want to take a moment to break the job creation down by resource. Solar creates about 15 to 30 jobs for each megawatt of capacity. The 15 is on the low end. That would be for centralized utility scale projects, and the 30 jobs per megawatt would entail more distributed type of generation, small commercial projects or residential projects. Biomass would also create about 9 direct jobs per megawatt, and 85% of the money spent on producing homegrown biomass power stays within a 75-mile radius of the plant, which stimulates the local economies. And it's important to note that 80 cents out of every dollar we spend on fossil fuel energy leaves the state. And homegrown power from resources such as biomass and solar keep most of our energy dollars in the state. Next slide, please. So there's a whole host of benefits to renewable energy. We discussed briefly jobs and economic development, but I did want to discuss how it protects ratepayers as well. First, you always hear that renewable energy is expensive, but the levelized cost of electricity generated from a biomass plant, the levelized cost is the cost of building and operating a plant over its economic life. It's comparable to larger base load type plants like coal and gas, which are available 24 hours, 7 days a week. And solar generated power's levelized cost is also comparable with peaking power plants, which sit idle much of the day and only produce extra power during summer and winter peak demand periods. For instance, in the summer when everyone's air conditioning is humming is when utilities would use peak power. So those resources are already sort of their profile is well equipped for those that type of generation. But the risks are also lower than conventional power because we've seen spiking fuel costs and ever-increasing construction costs. And we've seen double-digit increases in bills in the last several years from spiking fossil fuel costs and soaring construction costs for new power plants. Really, the state's energy mix should appear like a well-managed stock portfolio with diverse assets that hedge risk for the benefit of consumers. Fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas account for 73% of Florida's energy mix right now, which means that most of our energy dollars leave our state. And if the state doesn't change course, Florida will get almost half of its total electric supply from natural gas by 2017. And natural gas prices, as we're all aware, are volatile and dependent on unstable world events. And To move into the future, Florida really needs to boost its investment in low-risk renewable resources, which account for only 4% of our energy mix today. Additionally, capital construction costs of power plants are increasing. In fact, nuclear capital construction cost estimates have tripled from $2,500 for a kilowatt of capacity in 2005 to about $7,500 for a kilowatt of capacity in 2009. So you've got this trend where conventional power, where fuel costs and capital costs are generally trending higher. But by contrast, renewable sources such as solar have no fuel costs, and biomass uses a stable homegrown fuel source that keeps dollars spent on fuel in Florida. And also, capital construction costs for solar PV have steadily dropped from $27 per watt at peak in 1982 to about $4 today. So, you know, your energy mix is much like a stock portfolio. Renewables are your low-risk investment, and we have to do a better job of incorporating them into our energy mix. And there's some, bunch of other benefits of renewable energy as well, but due to time constraints, we'll move on to the next slide. So, what is renewable? Here's the definition in Florida law. You'll see that the resources that are highlighted in blue tend to be the resources that you will see in most other states. As renewable, there are some unusual resources in other states. For instance, in Nevada, used tires are a renewable resource. And believe it or not, in North Carolina, there are more pigs than people. So pig waste is a renewable resource in North Carolina. So what you'll find is that states tend to tailor their resources to the resources that are, you know, plentiful in their home states. Next slide, please. Okay, so what are other states doing to attract renewable energy investment? Well, they're creating renewable portfolio standards, sometimes called an RPS, sometimes called an RES. We've got them in 29 states and the District of Columbia, and about five more have aspirational goals. And what these standards do is they require utilities in the state to generate or procure a certain amount of their electricity from renewable resources. And the trend in these states is actually to increase their targets after they've had a few years of experience with an RPS. For instance, California just increased its target from 20% in 2010 to 33% by 2020. And Hawaii has also increased its target to 40% by 2035. And the trend is also to expand the RPS requirements on the state's utilities to smaller municipal utilities and cooperatives as well. And it's important to note that more than half of these RPS policies have been created since the beginning of 2004, so we're still getting sort of a lot of operational information on exactly how well they're working in these states. Next slide, please. And about half the states have what is called carve-outs. It's sort of an effective way of encouraging certain technologies. So wind and solar may have some attributes that policymakers find desirable. For instance, they're, you know, emission-free resources. So you encourage their use by requiring a certain percentage of an RPS to come from those resources. You may find that distributed generation is desirable. And so you want to limit the size, or you want to have a carve-out for really, you know, small systems. You want to limit the size of certain systems so private developers can get into the mix. Because ultimately, if you want to maximize the benefit of renewables, you know, to the grid and for drawing investment capital into the state, they need to be distributed. And they need to be not utility centralized type projects. But there's got to be really just a good mix of you know, some utility and most definitely you need private investors in the state building these projects and selling the electricity to the grid. And these types of set-asides, you know, the investment can be pretty substantial. Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories anticipates that it'll generate the construction of 500 megawatts by 2010, and that should grow to about 8,500 megawatts by 2025. And that's solar, that's just for solar carve-outs. And you likely wouldn't get that type of investment in solar if you didn't encourage its development through the use of set-asides. Next slide, please. So what are the rate impacts of these policies? Well, the experience has been in other states that it's actually been about, you know, it's been less than 1% generally. So the rate impacts have been minimal to date. And I think that that's something that the legislature, as it's deciding, you know, how to implement a renewable energy policy, will find very informative. Next slide. Okay, renewable energy credits. I just, real briefly wanted to talk with you about how renewable energy developers get paid, if you will. And this is sort of, this is, I won't hold you to this, there won't be a test on it afterwards, but it's something that most folks probably do have an understanding of, but if you don't, I just wanted to run through it real quick. The renewable portfolio standards that I've discussed so far use a renewable energy credit, also known as a green tag. It's a tradable commodity. It represents proof of a unit of electricity being generated from an eligible renewable energy resource. It's, if you will, it's the currency of an RPS. A utility must produce renewable, it has to produce renewable energy itself or obtain a renewable energy credit from somebody else to be in compliance. And generally, that would be an in-state renewable energy developer. It's also an additional payment stream, which provides incentive for developers to invest and go to the bank and provide certainty to bankers that they will be getting a payment above what is typically termed avoided cost, and that's the utilities. That's a benchmark cost. That is the utilities cost to provide the next incremental unit of electricity. But that cost is generally artificially low, according to third-party providers here in Florida. And what you need is you need that REC value. You need that value to take you well above avoided cost, so the project becomes worthwhile for you, so the developer has an adequate internal rate of return for the project. And also, for your bankers, you can take it to the bank and provide certainty. Financial institution. They're also tracked electronically. They can be bundled or unbundled, which means basically you can sell them with the electricity to a utility if you're a renewable energy developer, or you can just sell the electricity and then take the REC value and sell it somewhere else. For instance, businesses and individuals might also buy RECs to meet company or personal environmental goals. In fact, the Super Bowl this year recently purchased RECs to equal their electricity use from non-renewable resources, thereby offsetting their carbon emissions. And there's, there's short-term trades or long-term contracting in the renewable energy credit market, if you will. But more states are moving to longer-term contracting. And the reason for that is that renewable projects are capital-intensive, and concerns about the challenges of project financing with REC price variability. And that's sort of been the drawback of renewable energy credits is that when they're sold in or they're traded in short-term markets, it doesn't provide the certainty that many developers need for developing their projects, because you might have a REC price one day that's one value, and then a REC price another day that's another value. So what more states are moving to is to provide a little more certainty is to require actually long-term contracting. In fact, California, Montana, Nevada all require contract durations of at least 10 years. Colorado requires 20 years. Now, some utilities are moving to what's called standard offer contracts, and this is a long-term contract that is held out on a first-come, first-served basis. It's open, it's transparent, and it provides long-term certainty. Next slide, please. So as we start moving to these longer-term contracts that are open, that are transparent, we start getting closer to a feed-in tariff, which is, I'm sure, what a lot of people have heard about it, and it was certainly an idea that was considered last year in Tallahassee. And the difference between an RPS and a feed-in tariff is that a renewable portfolio standard regulates the target. And it pretty much leaves the price open to the market to decide what the price might be. A feed-in tariff, on the other hand, regulates the price, and it allows the market to determine how much renewable energy will be built at that price. There are positives and drawbacks of both systems. Gainesville recently enacted a feed-in tariff. I think it's the first municipality, and certainly in Florida, to do so. They set the target at 32 cents a kilowatt hour. And the average retail rate in Florida is about 12 cents a kilowatt hour. But Gainesville decided that's what developers needed for an adequate internal rate of return to get some of these solar projects off the ground. sometimes the problem you run into with feed-in tariffs is that it's hard to sometimes know whether you set the rate too high or too low to developers, but they are gaining steam. California and Hawaii are looking to integrate a feed-in tariff into their RPS plans, and Indiana, Michigan, and Minnesota legislators are also expected to introduce feed-in tariff bills this legislative session. Next slide, please. Okay. So what's in play this session? Well, we've got Senate Bill 774, which actually ratifies the 2008 Public Service Commission rule. I mentioned the Public Service Commission rulemaking process earlier in the presentation. It was about a 15-month process. The Public Service Commission promulgated a rule and then delivered it to the legislature for ratification, as was required in the previous year's bill. It was 20% by 2020. It had a set aside for one-fourth had to be met by solar or wind resources, which were termed Class 1. It had 2% investment cap, so retail rates couldn't exceed 2%, or from the payment of the electricity and the renewable energy credits. And it also split the investment cap, gave 75% to Class 1 resources and 25% to Class 2. Now, Senate Bill 596 is last year's clean energy portfolio standard. That was sort of the bill that was reworked from the PSC rule that was submitted to the legislature last year in Senator King's committee in the Senate. It also had a 20% by 2020 timeline and target, but it also included nuclear reactors and coal with carbon capture sequestration as Class 3 renewables, and one-fourth of the RPS could be met with those. So in essence, it was a 15% renewable portfolio standard. It also had a 2% investment cap, and it split 50-50 between Class 1 and Class 2. Excuse me. This year, Senator Bennett also has I'm losing my voice a little bit. Senator Bennett has a 700 megawatt as a bill out there, Senate Bill 1186, that would give early cost recovery to 700 megawatts of renewable energy projects.
I can pick up George if you're. I've got a little cold myself, so.
Thanks, Susan. If you don't mind, I appreciate it.
One of the concerns about the Senate Bill 1186, which Senator Bennett has, is while putting 700 megawatts of renewable energy over these 3 years is a really, significant amount, what it does is it doesn't allow, it would still continue to sort of keep this within the control of the utilities, and it wouldn't allow as much for sort of the little guy, and it certainly doesn't do much in the world of sort of biopower as well. So I don't know, in a year before last, in 2008, the legislature put 110 megawatts that was allowed for the utilities to pass through for cost recovery, and that was sort of immediately gobbled up by Florida Power and Light in those three plants. And again, we're pleased, to see those plants, but ultimately what we're trying to do here is creating a market for renewable energy, which includes all kinds of renewable energy and allows for a diverse market. So if we set up something that just can only take advantage of by the large utilities, then you're really not creating this market. So that's some of the concerns about that particular bill. And then the next bill, which I have to admit not having read because we just got a hold of it, that farm to energy, that is often referred to as a public benefit fund, a monthly utility charge that funds.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's often those public benefit funds, which include a monthly utility charge, sometimes have been portrayed by utilities or policymakers, as a negative thing, as if it is a tax. And so, anyway, sometimes that is a issue that is a little more difficult politically, but it does, have some broader support and now, and is picking up some steam from what I understand. George, did you have anything else on that particular bill?
No, that's it, Susan, pretty much. The way it would work is that monthly utility charge would be determined by the Public Service Commission, and it would create a pool of money, and it would be used to fund long-term contracts for renewable energy projects.
And then the last thing George mentioned, the Public Service Commission, there's been a lot of attention to communications with utilities and the Public Service Commissioners over Blackberries and pinning people. And so Senator Mike Fasano and John Lake have a bill on Public Service Commission reform. And it's interesting because, you know, we all come from this public interest perspective, or George, Tony, and I do. So I certainly am supportive of this idea of more either disclosure and not, you know, prohibiting the revolving door. You know, however, there are so many things at the Public Service Commission where the public would benefit from various kinds of reform in how utilities are regulated, that these communications, while they're super important, they only scratch the surface of the kinds of reform that's really needed at the Public Service Commission that is going to take away the barriers to energy efficiency, you know, capturing waste heat, and obviously a whole host of issues related to renewables. And so, Tony, why don't we just go to the next slide on this, and I can sort of start my comments a little bit. I just wanted to just make some general comments. We're going to talk about who the key players are, talk a little bit about the politics and what's coming up and what each one of you can do, and you can help us sort of grow this movement. But I want to just share with you, so tomorrow starts the legislative session. For me, it will be my 23rd legislative session, my first session. It's hard to believe that I was up here within 1987. And it's important for people understand that Tallahassee, you know, more often than not operates sort of on the whims of special interests and lobbyists and interest groups that give campaign contributions, often large campaign contributions, not only to the candidates' campaigns themselves, but also to the political parties. And there's various committees of continuing existence set up where money can go. Money can also go to larger groups like Associated Industries of Florida, you know, would be a group where utilities might put money in, and they might advocate for particular policies. So it's very important, and I so appreciate everybody's time on the phone and your willingness to be involved in this one way or another, because often in public interest type issues, the lawmakers don't hear from the general public because, you know, they're off living their very busy lives and not necessarily paying attention to this in a big picture way or into the minutia, which is really required to be involved. So George already mentioned all the states, 29 states that have renewable portfolio standards. So it's somewhat ironic that we're here once again having this very same conversation when we've been in this the process of developing a target for renewable energy. That's really the key concept here, is once you set a mandatory target, you create the certainty in the market that unleashes the investment and the jobs. So without the target, there's no certainty. And this is not a new idea. So the idea that Florida doesn't have a target for renewable energy when 29 other states do and five with non-binding targets just shows that you know, what's at play here, and that interest groups that either are not positioned to or don't feel like they'll benefit, or moving away from the centralized power plant, you know, sort of model rather than moving to distributed generation, you know, have really been winning, you know, the influence war, if you will. So let's talk a few minutes about who these key players are. In the Senate, Senator Jeff Atwater, the president of the Senate, I know many people on the phone care about the drilling issue. He's already put up some, you know, or slowed the process down about drilling and called for an analysis of drilling. And so he really is going to be a key decision maker in whether or not a renewable portfolio standard goes forward. Senator Lee Constantine is another important player. He chairs the Environmental Preservation Committee, as George mentioned, he's filed a bill that actually picks up the PSC's original draft rule recommendation to the legislature, which obviously got changed quite a bit and emerged as that Jim King bill that Nancy Dietert has now filed. Senator Alex Diaz de la Portilla is the chair of the Energy Committee. We've heard early on back during December and January committee meetings that Senator Jim King's bill, which is the Nancy Dietert bill, Senator King passed away. He was the chair of this committee, particularly last year, so that's why we often refer to it as the Jim King bill, that bill was going to be moved out as quickly as possible out of the Senate. Now, that Energy Committee has not had a whole lot of hearings. They had a hearing in December, and I haven't seen them meet since then. So originally, we were told that bill would move out rather quickly and then go over to the House. And, of course, that creates the dynamic where we were last year, where the energy bill went to the House or the renewable portfolio standard, and it was met with offshore oil drilling, which was being pushed primarily by State Representative Dean Cannon, who's from the Orlando area. In the legislature, you have 120 House members and 40 state senators, but the key decisions are made by a very small group of people, you know, the president of the Senate, the speaker of the House, majority leader, key committee members, the designated speakers, that are coming in the following years and subsequent years. But so anyway, we want to focus people on folks that are key decision makers. So the chair of the House Energy and Utility Committee, Stephen Precourt, and it's, again, not that everyone doesn't have a say. People, depending upon their political party, tend to have more of a say than others do. So you can see a list of the entire committee. Seth McKeel is quite important on that committee, and we have some good people, good voices from the Democratic Party as well, but the Republicans are in control of the legislature, so typically Republican members are going to be a little more in a position to make decisions. May I have the next slide, please? And the main, this is sort of organizing 101 and politics 101, is that these lawmakers really need to hear from people. They tend to hear from these organized interest groups. And if you are so inclined, and I know Carl Nurse is on the phone, so he'll agree with this, that, you know, not enough just sort of regular interested citizens, you know, write checks to political campaigns. So if you, now the state legislators aren't allowed to accept checks after today, as soon as the session starts. But anyway, if lawmakers regularly got campaign contributions from clean energy advocates, we'd probably be in better shape. We need you writing letters to the editor in your paper. If there was an article, which I'm sure there was, about the upcoming session opening, that's an opportunity for you to write a letter to the editor and say, you know, one of the key issues this session is setting a target for renewable energy to bring investment to the state and create jobs. Call and write your representatives. It actually absolutely does make a difference, and they do need to hear from people. And through the Climate Alliance, what we're trying to do is to create an infrastructure so that all of you guys can be involved easily. We know how busy everyone is, so we want to make it as simple as possible for you to sort of get an update so you know who to make your phone call to and what's happening that's most important.